that you'll be able to read God's Waiting Room, so I'm not going to preach that book. That actually, all of my books are the results of sermons. I just changed the format. But I want to read to you something in chapter 11 of John. Now, a certain man was sick named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary which anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sister sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, the sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Now get this. When he had heard therefore that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. So let me call your attention to three things here in these verses. I've got my notes all over the place here. So first of all, in verse 3, we find he's sick. So sickness was certainly more serious in those days than in our day. We can go down to the emergency room and all that. Then verse 5, it says that Jesus loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. So when we get to verse 6 and find that he abode 2 more days in the same place without responding to their plea, that means that the delay making them wait was a result of his love. Isn't that good? So I want us to learn. I'm going to give you a couple of stories and then we'll be done here tonight. But I want to give you 4 things that you really need to grasp whenever you're in a waiting situation. First of all, waiting does not mean inactivity. When I was a student at Temple, we had a fellow we called the Dandy, and he would sit over in the student center. We called it the Happy Corner. He'd sit over there with his feet propped up and a magazine in his hand and drinking a cup of coffee, and I'd go in and I'll say, hey, what's going on? Do you have a job yet? He said, no, I'm just waiting for God to provide. And so I'd say, well, you know, you probably ought to go looking for one. He said, look, God called me to preach, and if he wants me to preach, he's got to take care of me. So his concept of waiting was inactivity, right? I mean, well, it's not inactivity. So that's one principle we really need to grasp about waiting. If you're in a waiting situation, it's not inactivity. And secondly, when God forces you to wait, as Jesus, by delaying his response here, when he did that, he wasn't punishing Mary and Martha. He was instructing them. You know, he was giving them an opportunity. And then thirdly, some of the most potentially fruitful times in my life have been the delays where God said, wait. You know? And I say, yeah, but like you, Tom, I want to set a goal. I want to get it done. I want to jump on top of it, you know? And God says, okay, look, that's a big problem for you. You need to learn to wait. And so it's a potentially fruitful time. And here's something else about awaiting too. It's preparation opportunity. Sometimes when I've had a goal and God put a block on it and I had to wait, I actually got involved in something that developed me far beyond what I would have been had I not been waiting. You know, Moses waited, right? Sometimes our waiting is a result of somebody else's disobedience. So Moses had to wander around in the wilderness with the people of Israel all that time, and he just waited and waited. And you know, the sad thing about Moses, most people don't realize, you know, Moses committed the sin unto death. God told him, he said, now you smote the rock the first time and brought the water out. He said, this time you speak to the rock. 1 Corinthians 10 tells us why what seems like such an insignificant thing was significant. Paul said that rock was Christ. So what he did was he actually blasphemed a type of Christ. Now, I don't think he got up that morning. I don't think Moses got up and said, oh, let's see today, what can I do to blaspheme the name of God? Most of us don't do that. Most of us end up doing the wrong thing during a waiting period because we just aren't willing to wait on God. So it's a preparation of Moses waited. What about Joshua? He waited, you know. What about Joseph? Would you like to be in that situation? God gave him this vision and said, this is what's going to happen. And so then he gets thrown in the pit and he gets sold into the caravan. Then he gets taken to Potiphar's house. Then he has to deal with Potiphar's wife. Then he gets into prison. Waiting. You know? But the interesting thing about that is every time you find a reference to Joseph during that period of time when he was waiting for what God's vision was to be fulfilled, somebody always said, oh, we know the Lord is with him. Potiphar knew it. The head of the prison knew it. And Pharaoh said, hey, how would you like to be number two? So he elevated him to that position. What about David? Samuel, God told him, look, I'm taking the kingdom away from Saul. So what you need to do is go down to Jesse's house. Goes down there. Looks at all of them. And God says, no. He says, Samuel says, is there any? Oh, yeah, we got one that's out there taking, you know, the little kid taking care of the sheep. Go get him. So he brings him in. God said, yeah, it's the one. So Samuel anoints him. But he doesn't go to the throne. 15 years of waiting. Can you imagine that? But look at all he did during that period of time. He didn't go sit out there and play on his flute and say, well, I sure hope the Lord puts me on the throne. He actually was busy. He was serving the man he was going to replace. He was loyal to the man he was going to replace when the man he was going to replace was trying to kill him. And then he was constantly leading his men in military battle, winning victory after victory. And he made friends with Saul's son. And he was busy for 15 years. You know? What about Daniel? Nebuchadnezzar comes in, three separate deportations, 606, 597, 587, takes people away from Israel. In the first deportation, probably the one that Daniel and the three Hebrew young men were taken in. Can you imagine being called to serve the Lord and ending up having to wait in a foreign country for 70 years? And it was 70 years before part of the group came back. Only a small number came back compared to the ones that were taken in captivity. They all waited. So a lot of people in the Bible waited, and the waiting was not always a bad thing. So here's what I'd like to do. I had a technical section here, but I'm not going to give you the technical section. I went ahead and looked up, you know, trying to impress everybody with how much I knew about Hebrew and Greek. And I looked up all the words translated, waiting and everything like that. So I'm going to ignore that. Is that okay with you? What I'd like to do is tell you a couple of stories about how God used waiting. You've got to keep in mind what Brother Stiles said a while ago. I did not know what he was going to preach on, and he did not know that I'd written a book dealing with that. But I was trying to think. I don't know exactly, but I was in the ministry a long, 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 long time before I even realized how important waiting was. Matter of fact, I was in the ministry a long time before I realized what anything was. And what really amazes me is that I keep on learning. You know, 65 years of doing this, you'd think by now I'd know what I was doing. But let me give you one story. I served in the U.S. Air Force, and when I came home, I had my plan for my life. Here's what I said. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to marry the girl I've been dating. She's a pastor's wife. I'm going to go ahead and transfer into the Air National Guard and work full time, build the little house with a picket fence, have children and a dog, and then I'll come and work with the pastor and run a bus route in the church. My plan. That's what I was going to do. Well, the pastor died from cancer, and the church called a man by the name of Bill Compton, who was on the board of trustees at Tennessee Temple. He'd been in evangelism for years. So I said, I explained to him one day, he said, what are you going to do with your life, guy? I said, well, I'm going to work full-time in the Air National Guard. I'm going to retire, get a good pension, I'm going to get married, have children, you know, and then I'm going to work your bus route here in the church for you. And Pastor Compton said to me, he said, why don't you wait? Wait on what? He said, wait before you pursue that direction. He said, let's get together and talk. And then we got together and he said, do you know what it means to wait on God? And I said, no, not really. He said, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to find out what God's plan is for your life. Sounds to me like you got your own plan down really well. And I said, yeah. He said, but that's not the one that should work. He said, you need God's plan. I said, oh, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to go to Tennessee Temple for one semester. And he said, if you don't like Tennessee Temple and you don't believe God wants you there, you come on home, I'll never mention it again, I'll buy you a bus and you can run your bus route. I said, well, that sounds pretty good to get you off my back. I didn't tell him that. But, you know, what happened is I had deliberately chosen to expose myself to an environment in which God could speak to me more effectively. And even, I was at Tennessee Temple 4 years. I didn't come back after the first semester. And when I had him preach for me over in New York one day, I said, you remember how you got me to go to Temple? He said, yeah, I got a lot of people on that one. Get them to commit to one semester. But here's what happened. When I look back at that period of time, when I was at Temple, I was in waiting mode. But I wasn't inactive. I worked on the Highland Park Baptist Church bus route. I pastored one of the chapels. I spoke in the every Friday night in the hospital. We had a program there. I carried an 18-hour load, and I worked a 55-hour job. Had a lot of spare time, you know, to do. But here's what I look back on that waiting, and here's some of the things that by waiting happened in my life. By waiting and going to Tennessee Temple instead of doing what I planned, I avoided a tragic marriage. That pastor's daughter was married, divorced 3 times. By waiting, I saw more alternatives for ministry than I ever thought existed. You know? By waiting, I met the woman who has spent 56 years as my wife. By waiting, I was exposed to some of the most powerful preachers in America. I mean, the names of those preachers are just amazing. And then by waiting, I learned some skills about ministry that I never even knew existed. And it was all because waiting was not inactivity. That's one of the things we need to get. Waiting is not inactivity, but delaying what I wanted so that God could develop me for what He wanted for my life. Let me give you another example. Those days at Tennessee Temple were pretty important. And so for 4 years, I was actively waiting. Boy, I was busy. I was going all the time. And God continued to reveal Himself to me. But while waiting there, I not only worked a bus route and I only pastored a chapel, but I also earned my degree. And when I was asked to become a chapel pastor, Dr. Robertson had 70 chapels. And he used those for young men who were who believed God had called them to preach. He'd put them in there and let them learn what it was like to be a pastor. Well, mine was the Beaverdale Chapel outside of Dalton, Georgia. And I worked with a married couple, Bob and Gail Huffman, students at Temple. Bob and Gail later left and went to Argenteuil, France. And for 50 years, built one of the most amazing ministries in France. I've been over there and preached for them. And Bob died a few years back of pancreatic cancer. But it was a blessing to work with them. But at that chapel, God used an unsaved farmer to teach me about waiting, active waiting. So, like I say, I was working my way through 4 years of Temple. I served a lot of different jobs, and one of the men that I led to Christ owned a logging company. So he told me, he said, why don't you leave this job over here where you're making $1.15 an hour? And he said, come drive a logging truck for me. And he said, I'll pay you $2.25 an hour. So sounded like a good deal to me, and I did that. And that meant I had to come down from Chattanooga and be there Friday and Saturday to work for him and then Sunday for the chapel service. So I went ahead and did that, and the farmer's wife was saved, and his two daughters were saved. But the farmer was not saved. But he came to me, and he said, I know what's happening here. So he said, if you want a room, you can come down here. And he said, we'll give you our guest room. You can stay in that guest room. And he said, what will happen is we'll feed you, and all you have to do is when you're not on the logging run, you'll have to help me on the farm. I said, okay, I can do that. So I got involved. I mean, I helped him with cleaning the stalls. I helped him with milking the cows. I helped him with putting up hay. Whatever work had to be done, I was willing to do it. And one day we were out working, and I was helping him clean stalls. And I just got this thought. This is a young preacher's thought. The whole world's going to hell. I need to drop out of Tennessee Temple and spend more time soul winning. So I'm standing there, you know, and I'm shoveling like this, and the farmer's shoveling over there. So I stopped, and I put my shovel in the ground. I put my arms up on the shovel, and I said, you know something? The whole world's going to hell. I think I'll drop out of Tennessee Temple, and move out here. And if you let me rent your house, I'll rent your house there, and I can win more people for Christ. The farmer kept working. He said nothing. So I repeated my statement. He still kept working, said nothing. And this is not made up. His name really was Farmer Brown. I said, hey, Farmer Brown. He said, yeah. I said, did you hear what I said? He said, yeah, I heard you. And I said, well, what do you think? He stopped and he leaned on his shovel and peered at me with his steady blue eyes, and he said after a few seconds, son, if a farmer has a job to do, he ought to sharpen his tools. Seems you ought to do the same. So I went back to waiting on God instead of doing what I... You know what the danger of not waiting? The main reason we don't wait? Impulse. And you know that impulse is, if you read Galatians chapter 5 and check out the Greek words there, impulse is actually a work of the flesh. Yeah. I'm not saying the Holy Spirit can't use it sometimes, but there it is. Well, let me give you, those were pretty good ones there. Let me give you one where I made maybe one of the biggest mistakes in my life because I didn't wait. I think this was it here. I left Tennessee Temple, and I went down to Dallas Theological Seminary, and I got to study under J. Dwight Pentecost, John Walford, Stanley Toussaint, Charles Ryrie. I mean, all the guys that had written all the books, you know, all the textbooks. And my wife and I had delayed having any children, but she became pregnant, and we got a child coming, so the seminary had a regulation that Dallas Seminary ranks academically right up there with Harvard, Yale, and Princeton theological seminaries. And so Dallas Seminary said, if you're taking a full load at Dallas Seminary, you can't work a full-time job unless you have special permission to do so. Well, the only job I could get was a full, so I sent a letter to Dr. Campbell, the registrar. And I said, Dr. Campbell, I said, I know what the rule is. And I said, I am taking a full load here. But I said, my wife is pregnant. She's going to have to drop out of her job pretty soon. And I'm going to have to, go to work. And the only job I can get is a full-time job. And we got to have that money to pay my school bill and everything. So I put all this in the letter and I sent it to him. And I waited a week, didn't hear anything. And the guy at the job said, I gotta know whether you're gonna take this or not. So, you know, the Bible says that if a man provide not for his own household, he's worse than an infidel and has denied the faith, right? So I had that pretty clearly in my mind. So I had promised my wife's father, if he would let me marry her, that I'd take care of her. So I go out and I take the job. And I drop by the office over there and I said, is Dr. Campbell got any comments for me? And the secretary said, no, what are you talking about? I said, well, I'd send him a letter. She said, we don't have any letter from you. And so I said, well, I sent him a letter requesting that he let me work full time. And so then I got this notice from J. Dwight Pentecost, one of the top theologians in America, as far as I'm concerned. A great theologian and a great teacher. So he calls me in, and he's my advisor for my master's thesis. And he calls me in, and I barely had walked in the door before I was stunned. He just verbally started attacking me for lying and being dishonest and not following procedures. And then he said, "You've gone out," and he said, you've gotten a full time. And I said, hold it. I said, "I wrote a letter." He said, "You're lying. You didn't write a letter. I talked to Dr. Campbell. He did not have a letter from you." Now, if I really believed in biblical waiting, I probably would have gone to a couple of other people, maybe the president, John Walvert. And if I had been in a waiting mood, I would have said, "Look, we need to work this thing out." But impulse. You're not going to treat me that way, even if you are J. Dwight Pentecost. So I came home. I walked out of his office. He said, "Don't you turn your back on me." I said, "I'm not going to put up with this, Doc." I said, "That's very rude. I'm not going to put up with it." So I walked out of his office. By the way, don't let this story keep you from reading J. Dwight Pentecost. Still one of the greatest theologians in America. So I walked out and refusing to wait and consider this God using a difficult opportunity to teach me how to build a relationship. I decided that nobody was going to talk to me that way. And I walked out. I went home. And I packed the bags. My wife comes home from her, she's on her last week of work. She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "We're leaving." "Leaving? What do you mean we're leaving? We came here for you to, finish your degree at Dallas." I said, "No, we're leaving." I said, and I told her the story. And she said, "I think you ought to go talk to someone." I said, "You know who I am? I'm the head of the house, man. You don't tell me what to do." I didn't tell her that. That's what I thought. I'd have stayed out of a lot of trouble if I'd listened to my wife. I have stayed out of a lot of trouble. But anyway, the long and short of it was this. I went in and turned in my withdrawal form and walked out and called my wife's parents, and they came down and brought their car and a trailer. We took their car and our car and two trailers, packed everything up, and moved to the University of Tennessee. And I hadn't even applied there. And finally, I just went in and turned in an application. And they said, "Well, classes start day after tomorrow." And I said, "Well, I'm here. Can I take classes?" Long story. I'll just pass it over. I eventually got enrolled at the University of Tennessee to major in English. And so I guess about 15 years later, I got a call from a pastor in Louisville, Kentucky. And he said, "Brother Goodell, can you come over here and preach in a Bible conference for me?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I was planning to come to your conference. You got John Walvert, you got Charles Ryrie, and you got J. Dwight Pentecost coming. I was planning to come to hear all three of them." He says, "Well, here's the thing. Dr. Pentecost has got laryngitis and he can't come." So he said, "I need you to preach with Charles Ryrie and John Walvert." And I'm saying, abba-dab. So I said, "Okay, I'll do the best I can." So I got over there. Dr. Walvert sitting on one side, Dr. Ryrie on the other. And so I chatted with Dr. Ryrie a few minutes. Dr. Ryrie was not very chatty. So I was talking over to Dr. Walvert over here, and he's chatty. So we're talking a little bit. And he said, "Have you ever thought about coming to Dallas Seminary?" I said, "I was there." "When?" I said, "The first 2 years, 2 years, 66, 67, 68. And he said, "What happened?" So I told him this story. And he said, "You know something interesting?" And I said, "What?" He said, "If you had waited, 6 weeks later, Dr. Campbell came to me and showed me a letter that had been put in his box that had fallen down behind his desk. But I didn't wait. Dr. Walford, I told him, I said, "Well, Dr. Walford," I said, "it's probably one of the biggest mistakes I've made in my life." And the gracious man that he was, he said, isn't it great to know that Romans 8:28 means that even when you mess up, God can use it?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "One of the greatest lessons that I learned was from that stupid decision that I made." It really was. I asked Dr. Walford, I said, "Doc, what are you going to preach on?" He said, "I'm going to preach on the rapture." I said, "Well, you probably know a little bit about that, right?" He said, yeah. He's written several books on it. He said, "What are you going to preach on?" I said, "Heaven." He said, "Well, that goes together, right?" I said, "Yeah." And I said, "I didn't even know what you were preaching on." So he got up and he preached on the rapture. And then I got up and preached on heaven. I said, "This is where we're going after the, you know, when the rapture occurs." I got through preaching, and I came down off the pulpit, and I sat down by Dr. Walford, and he had his handkerchief out, and he was dabbing his glasses off, and he was dabbing his eyes. I reached over, and I put my arm on his shoulder, and I said, "Doc, are you okay?" "Yeah. You just made me homesick." It wasn't too many years later that he resigned, and then, of course, he passed away, went on to be with the Lord. So, don't be discouraged if you're waiting. Waiting is a spiritual holding pattern. Usually, let me close by giving you this little anecdote here. Dr. Lee Robertson, probably 4 years before he resigned. No, he had already resigned Highland Park, so he was going around. And so we talked about his resignation and everything. And so I'd ask him to come and preach over in Hudson Falls, New York. And he came and he preached 2 great days there, Monday and Tuesday. And Tuesday night, when he flew in, he had his secretary make the reservations. He flew into Albany. I told him Albany is the best place because I can get there in 45 minutes. But he flew into Albany coming up, and that's where I picked him up. So whenever I asked him about taking him back to Albany, "I'm not going to Albany." I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm flying out of JFK. I said, "Doc, that's 5 hours away." He said, "Well, I thought it was okay." He said, "It's New York." I said, "Yeah, but New York..." So I had a friend that owned a Cessna 182. You know what that is? Cruises about 135 or 40 knots, and it's got all the variable pitch prop, all the fancy stuff on it. So I called this lady, and I said, "Can I borrow your 182? And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, Dr. Robertson, you know, I've got to get him down to JFK. And I said, "There's no way we can drive him down there." I said, "The service will be over at 8, and his plane leaves at midnight." I said, "There's just no way we can get him there." And she said, "Sure, you can borrow the plane." So I go and I get check the plane out and everything, and I put him in the plane, and the lady brings him out. Most people didn't know this, but Dr. Robertson, he loves caramel corn. And so she brought him a great big thing of caramel corn there, you know. And so he's sitting over there, and he's eating his caramel corn, and I'm flying the plane, and we're about... I guess we're about 25 miles from JFK. And so I call and I say, "JFK approach. This is 18 Bravo Hotel, 4500, requesting landing." "Oh, 18 Bravo Hotel, you'll be number 27. He said, "If you go out to intersection Alpha and do 360s, we'll let you know when it's your turn to come in." And I said, "I don't think I have enough gas to do that, you know." But he sent us out there, and we're in a holding pattern. That's what I feel like somehow. I'm in a holding pattern. I'm flying around in circles. I'm not going anywhere. All I got to do, I got to maintain my altitude, and I got to just fly around that electronic place out there called Alpha. So I'm out there flying around, and I'm looking over at the gas gauges there, and they're down to about a quarter of a tank. And that's still not dangerous, but you don't like it when it gets low. It's not like with a car, you know, where you can just pull it off the road there. So I called back and I said, "JFK, This 1-8 Bravo Hotel, we're still at intersection Alpha here. Is there any way you can work us in? I said, my gas is really running low out here. And then I hear this pilot. Remember the old Electras, the old aircraft? I heard this pilot, he was calls in, he said, hey, approach control, this is Electra 478. He said, let that young man in ahead of me. He said, I fly one of those things myself. And he said, when the gas gets that low, it's a little shaky. So they said, okay, if you'll proceed, you know, you can get in ahead of Electra. So I did follow what they told me to do, descended where they told me to descend, and whenever I landed that thing, I was really so great. But I was in a holding pattern. Now, I won't tell you the specifics, but I want to tell you. You don't like waiting, right? I don't like waiting. I'm learning to be more creative as a waiter. But I am right now in a 41-year-long holding pattern. And exactly what I'm supposed to do, I have no idea. So while I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing, I'm doing stuff. Let's pray. Lord, we love You. We thank You that You love us enough to make us wait. We thank You that we can't consider some